Here we are live right now, right on the church's website, if you are looking for another way to get that, okay? If you're here or on YouTube, if you're on YouTube, you can click the link beneath the window, and you will be able to access the PowerPoint notes. The other option would be for you to go to gracelifebiblechurch.com, and you can find the notes that I'm going to be teaching from right here, lesson 162, the work in progress documents. So I am going to go ahead and just open those up so that we have access to them as we get started, okay? So, it's been a couple weeks since we had this class. The last time we met was on December 19th, which is the same Sunday that we had our Christmas fellowship. And then the last two Sundays, Brother Bud Chrysler has been teaching the lesson, and I appreciate him being able to do that. But I'm anxious to get started with this again and keep moving forward. So this is a long set of notes. I'm going to take my time. If I have to push some of this off, I'm going to do that. I'm not going to rush through this information just for the sake of getting it done. But we are going to try to move at a reasonable pace through the material this morning. So lesson 126, the work in progress documents, analyzing the pre-1611 evidence for the text. So if you don't remember where we were at, I have a few things here to hopefully help you review. So before our holiday break, in lesson 161, we sought to establish a general timeline for how the various companies of translators conducted their work. In general, we established the following general working timeline. So I'm going to try to make this as big as I can for the benefit of somebody who might be watching us on the internet to try to squeeze that in there, okay? So what we identified 3 weeks ago in lesson 161 was three stages of work, all right? Stage one was from 1604 to 1608. Remember we talked about how the various companies got started, some earlier than others, and that their stage one work, their company work, their stage one work took roughly between 1604 and 1608, depending on the company. Some finished early. We talked about some possibly finishing as early as 1607, right? So the six companies produced their drafts of the translation between 1604 and 1608, right? Then, we talked about Lambeth Palace Manuscript 98, and that represents the first stage of the text during stage one. So Lambeth Palace Manuscript 98 is one of the three primary work-in-progress documents that we're going to be talking about here, and that was done by the second Westminster Company that worked on the New Testament epistles from Romans to Jude. That was a document that they produced, and we'll be talking more about that in a minute. Then we talked about the Bod 1602 document, the annotated 1602 Bishop's Bible that is in the possession of the Bodleian Library over in at Oxford right now, that bridges the gap between Manuscript 98 and what would happen at the general review meeting or meetings. And we did talk about the possibility that there was a series of general review meetings that dealt with different sections of the text, although we can't say for sure on that one way or the other, okay? So then stage two of this would have been between 1609 and 1610 at the general meeting or meetings where the review and company drafts were established and the text that was to be printed was basically established there. And here we have the notes of John Boyce that bear witness to this process. So that would be our third primary source work in progress document, would be the notes of John Boyce, okay? So that was stage two that we talked about back in lesson 161. I was just going to mention that, Craig, but about grabbing the notes. And then stage three is in 1611 itself, where two men, notably Thomas Bilson and Miles Smith, work with the king's printer, Robert Barker, to see the text through to the press. So we talk about these three stages of the process. Stage one, stage two, stage three. We talked about what evidence, what surviving primary source evidence there is to triangulate with these different steps in the process. And then finally we discussed how there were two separate printings in 1611 that bear witness to the final decisions of the translators. So two separate sizes are printed. Now, I'll talk more about this in a minute, but since the last time we had class, I picked up a very rare book that has in it a flyleaf from a 1611 Bible. So this is an actual page. The size of the page, this is what it actually would have looked like. This is from the print, the famous printing known as the She Bible. It's called the She Bible because there was a famous printer error. I forget the exact verse off the top of my head, but they put She when they should have put He. And so this is a famous page. This happens to be from the Apocrypha, but this book that was published in 1956, that I'll talk more about here in a minute, famously included a flyleaf of the famous She Bible from 1611. So the stage three evidence are the two 1611 printings that actually came off the press and then were sold and distributed, etc., to the people of England at that time. So, look at the next point. Having established a general working timeline, I would like to consider the three work-in-progress documents in greater detail. While we have mentioned these in our studies previously, they are each worthy of their own consideration. Once again, the three documents are Manuscript 98, Bod 1602, and the Notes of John Boyce. Those are the three documents that we're going to be talking about. Those are the three documents that I placed and triangulated, guys, in this Stage 1, Stage 2, Stage 3 timeline here that's at the top of the notes. So those are the documents that we're going to be talking about. Now, I have something I want to say about that before we really get rolling. Until very recently, King James advocates and defenders had been largely ignorant of these three documents and how a working knowledge of their contents illuminates one's understanding of what took place between 1604 and 1611, as well as the final product. Please recall, on Sunday, October 18, 2020, I taught a lesson here in the Sunday School Hour titled A Brief History of the King James Only Movement, in which I argued that the King James Only Movement that developed in the 20th century did so without an awareness, much less a working knowledge of the relevant primary sources, i.e., the three work-in-progress documents discussed in this lesson. I talked to you about that in that lesson back on October 18, 2020, how the King James Only train left the station in the middle half of the 20th century without really any working knowledge of the three primary documents that we're going to be discussing this week and in the weeks to come. So that means then, so this is my editorial comment, that means then that things were said about the King James Bible that were not based upon the documents, that were not based upon the surviving primary source documents that speak to what actually occurred, okay? And in my mind, that has led to things that have been said that have not been true, that have not been accurate. For example, one of them being this idea that they didn't really follow Rule 1 stands out as a primary, just easy example of that, right? So, look at the last point on page 1. Adam Nicholson, author of the 2003 book, God's Secretaries, The Making of the King James Bible, drives this point home regarding these three documents when he wrote, quote, "It was an intense, competitive, and vitalized world." He's speaking there about the world of the translators. But the question remains, how did the Bible emerge from it? How did the selected men deliver? After the initial flurry of documents, there was a dearth of evidence almost until the final printed volume appeared in 1611. Once the king had decided it should happen, once Bancroft had disseminated the rules, and once the translators had been chosen, almost the entire process drops from view. Now let's just stop there. That's what I've said, right? That's why we spent a whole lesson in Lesson 161 trying to establish a working timeline of what happened. So it's almost like, just think of it this way. At the beginning, we have all this documentation, and then we have the final product in 1611. But what happened between 1604 and 1611, it's almost like, poof, the lights go out, and no one really knew. Or there was not a lot known about what occurred during that process. So picking up the quote, "A few tiny glimpses remain. In November 1604, the ubiquitous Lancelot Andrews, should say Andrews, was asked to attend a society of antiquarians to which he had been elected in the same summer. He sent a note to Mr. Hartwell, secretary of the society, to excuse his absence because, quote, this afternoon is our translation time. As the Oxford antiquarian, Anthony Wood recorded, some of the Oxford translators began meeting once a week in John Reynolds' room in Corpus Christi College, and that, quote, it is said perfected the work, notwithstanding, the doctor said, who had the chief hand in it, and all the while sorely afflicted with the gout. Beyond that, of the beginning of the process, there was for centuries almost nothing to say. More recently, though, scholars have made discoveries which throw some real light on the process, in particular, three long-hidden manuscripts. Nicholson's statement here is made in reference to manuscript 98 and William Eyre's 1608 letter covered in lesson 161 and Bod's 1602. Okay, so let's just stop there. Nicholson is saying what I said last in the fall of 2020. That is, that much of this stuff was totally unknown until relatively recently. All right, because these documents had been tucked away in the libraries in Great Britain, and people were either A, not aware they were even there, or two, if they were aware they were there, they had overlooked the significance of what the documents have to say about the actual process of the translation of the King James Bible. While Nicholson's comments cited above do not extend to the notes of John Boyce, a topic we will cover later in this lesson, they do draw to the surface the notion that the scholarly world at large was unaware of manuscript 98 and Bod 1602 and how they might impact one's understanding of how the King James Bible came about. Over the next couple lessons, we want to look at each of these three primary work-in-progress documents in terms of the following points. So I want to look at all three of them, and I want to look at the following three points about all three of them. So first, I want to look at scholarly awareness and published access. So in other words, when was the scholarly world aware of their existence, and when was access to them available to the public through a published document, okay? Second, I want to look at their physical description of their physical contents, the physical description and contents. And then third, I want to talk about the most important thing in all of this, and that is how do they impact the readings found in the King James Bible, okay? So that was a little bit longer introduction than normal, but that's kind of where this is going. So I do kind of feel like I want to pause there and see if anybody has any questions about where I'm taking this or anything I've said so far. No questions? Okay. So then let's get into the first point, which is scholarly awareness and published access. So if you're following along with me online or you just came late, we're at the bottom of page 2 at this main point. Okay. In this section, I want to look at when the scholarly community was aware of each document's existence, as well as when the public was granted access to the document in question via published works. We will address the work-in-progress documents in the following order. The first one we're going to talk about is Manuscript 98, then we'll talk about Bod 1602, and if we have time, we'll talk about the notes of John Boyce, okay? So like I said at the beginning, we're not going to rush through this. We're going to go at an appropriate speed. If we get done with all of it, so be it. If not, that's fine with me as well. We'll just go at the pace we need to go. So at the top of page 3 is where we begin the discussion of Manuscript 98. So, Adam Nicholson states the following regarding the original placement of the document in the Lambeth Palace Library. Quote, "It belonged at one stage to the life of William Sancourt, the passionate Emmanuel undergraduate who later became Archbishop of Canterbury. He gave it to the library housed above the cloisters of the Archbishop, the Archbishop of London's palace at Lambeth, where Richard Bancroft had established it, England's first public access library in 1610. Okay? So, let's understand what that comment's saying. This document was originally owned or possessed by this gentleman named William Sancourt. He himself later became an Archbishop of Canterbury. And the document ends up in the Lambeth Palace Library. And it makes sense that it would end up there because the Lambeth Palace was the household of the Archbishop of Canterbury. So this guy's document ends up, we don't know exactly what year, in the possession of the Lambeth Palace Library. That library was established in 1610 by then Archbishop Richard Bancroft. So does everybody understand that so far? Okay. The Lambeth Palace Library database of manuscripts and archives online offers a bit more detail on the custodial history of the document. So I'm getting this right off their website in this next quote. In the library by 1647. So is it known to be in the library by the year 1647? Okay. Cambridge shelf marked bundle 4, number 3, Tanner manuscript 274. I think this is, means folio 29, recto epistles of Saint Paul, James, Peter, John, and Jude, Anglis, with Archbishop Sancroft's edition of the Newmark folio volume 98. So I included that to be technical, but all of that is the data that is used to demarcate this document in the library's possession. You've all heard of the Dewey Decimal System, right? I don't even know if anybody uses it anymore now that computers have become a thing, but you know how they would catalog things in a library using that system. This is kind of that idea, right? This is how they have it logged in their records. That manuscript 98 was in the library by 1647, implying that it was in the collection of either Archbishop Richard Bancroft or Archbishop George Abbott, was not known to Ward Allen and other scholars. Example, Nicholson, Power and Glory, page 148, suggests that Sancroft gave it to the library. End quote. Okay? So, this document, manuscript 98, is in the possession of the Lambeth Palace Library. It is known to have been there at some time prior to 1647. The custody of the document before that is a little bit fuzzy. It either belonged to Bancroft himself, Archbishop George Abbott, or Sancroft, and it is in the library, and it was not really known. It's referenced by Nicholson, as we just saw, and maybe a few others. So look at the next point. From this, we learn the following. Number one, the document was logged and in the possession of the Lambeth Palace Library by the year 1647. Number two, important scholars such as Ward Allen and Adam Nicholson were not aware of this fact when they authored their respective works on the topics. So they were aware of it. They did not know, though, that it was logged in the library by 1647. According to Adam Nicholson, the document lay in the library's keeping, quote, uninspected and unvalued for nearly three centuries until 1955. All right, let's look at the quote. This manuscript, number 98, remained in the library uninspected, excuse me, and unvalued until a Californian scholar, E.E. Willoughby, recognized it for what it was in 1955. It is still there today and can be requested from the shelves by anyone who walks in off the embankment. Why is it not more famous? Why not more treasured? It should be, because this very nearly uniquely is as near as any of us will ever come to a manuscript of the King James Bible. Okay? So this document is of extremely important significance. Now I want to show you a couple things here. So here is the Lambeth Palace Library, and they have released a selected number of images of the document. Okay? So here is the way it is currently looked at. It is a book. It's about, I don't know, that thick. And it's got on the spine, Pauline and Catholic epistles. If you go to the inside flyleaf, you can see plainly what it is. Let me see if I can zoom in. No, I don't want that. I don't want the code either. I just want to make... This is why the internet gets irritating. Here we have it. An English translation of the epistles of Paul the Apostle and James, 1st and 2nd Peter, of John, 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and who? Jude. So this is the Lambeth Palace Library manuscript. We can view the actual images on their website for those that have been released to the public. They have not released access to the whole thing. There's probably 10 to 12 images that we'll be checking out or that have been released to the public. But this is the document that we're talking about right here. It is of the New Testament epistles, the Pauline epistles, and then also the epistles of James, the epistle of James, Peter, John, and Jude. Okay? Any questions about that? So, Edwin Elliot Willoughby, bottom of page 3, is the author of the extremely rare and expensive 1956 publication, The Making of the King James Bible, a monograph with comparisons from the Bishop's Bible and the manuscript annotations of 1602, with an original flyleaf of the Great She Bible of 1611. According to Penn Libraries of the University of Pennsylvania, only 290 copies were ever printed for sale. The board of GLBC approved me picking up a copy of this rare and expensive book using funds from the printing ministry. In the preface dated August 29, 1955, Willoughby states the following. Top of page 4. He says, quote, "The present monograph has been taken from a larger work upon which I have been engaged since 1938. For an opportunity to spend a year in England, during which time I discovered the two documents of the translators of the 1611 King James Bible, I thank the trustees of the Fulgur Shakespeare Library and its director, Dr. Lewis B. Wright. To the Bodleian Library, I am equally grateful for permission to reproduce a page of the 1602 Bishop's Bible, in which changes by the translators of the King James Bible had been copied before they were revised. I also thank Miss I.J. Churchill, the former librarian of the Lambeth Palace Library, for calling this manuscript of the epistles to my attention, and Mr. W.H. Hansen, reference librarian of the Bodleian Library, for directing me to the 1602 annotated Bishop's Bible," and that is from Willoughby's unnumbered preface, okay? So, this is the book that we're talking about. This book was published in 1956, and it's titled The Making of the King James Bible. The reason it's so big, and I kind of already said this already, but we might have some folks who are just joining us now, it contains a flyleaf page of a 1611 She Bible. This is how big it was. Okay? So you think about, remember we studied the Great Bible and we talked about how big the Great Bible was? A 1611 King James was not a pocket edition. It was a pretty significant and substantial book. So in this book, Willoughby talks about his experiences as he is going through the library, and we can also I just also want to show you the last page of this. This is not necessarily a long book, but notice it talks about right there how there were only 290 copies of this that were ever printed. Okay? So this is a pretty significant book for me to have access to, and I do want to thank the board for letting me use the money to pick this up, because there's things in here that I could not find necessarily anywhere else, and it was good to read from Willoughby himself about his experience of going there, realizing what he's looking at as he's looking at some of these documents. Okay. Now, a photo of Romans 1 in manuscript 98 was included by Willoughby on page 24. Now, we already showed you this photo. I showed this to you last time. Here is manuscript 98. Here's Romans 1. Here's the insignia of the Palace Library on the top. And then we have the epistle of St. Paul, the apostle to the Romans. And then we have the first chapter. And he has a picture of that on page 24 of this book. So I will say that both the Lambeth Palace Library and the Bodleian Library have been extremely stingy on what they've been willing to release to the public. Okay, but here you can see the same page that is up there on the screen. Here's the insignia of the library here, and the beginning of Romans chapter 1, the same as we can see right here. Okay? All right, let's just stop there. Anybody have any questions? Now, for somebody like me, this is like way cool to be looking at this yourself. I mean, you're looking at a document that, in Nicholson's words, is as close as you're ever going to get to reading the manuscript draft work. You are reading the manuscript draft work of the King James translators when you look at this document. Okay?
So, the whole manuscript is handwritten.
Mm-hmm.
And there was only one.
That we know.
Okay, but, so when did it get bound together in a book? Like,
it was always...
So the translators had it put in a...
The translators of this company clearly put this together to function as some sort of a document recording their draft works. And the evidence suggests that it was always a singular volume. You have a question?
I just wonder when it got put bound together.
I don't know when they put it in a binding like it is now, okay. But that's the way it is now. They probably had it loose, would be my guess, and then it was bound at some point. But it is their draft work. Okay? Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
So, a photo of Romans 1 in manuscript 98 was included by Willoughby on page 24. I've showed you that here online, and I showed you that in the book. This is the same image that is visible on the Lambeth Palace Library website. I just said that. And there is also some light discussion of the manuscript's significance on pages 26 and through 28 of Willoughby. Okay? Now, I want to say, Willoughby's treatment of it is not exhaustive. He mentions it. He talks about it. He gives, like, a handful of examples of the readings from it. But it is definitely not exhaustive of the entire document. All right? Regarding the significance of these two finds, Willoughby writes the following on page 21. He says, quote, It has long been thought impossible to evaluate the work performed by these revisers. This was all the more noteworthy because two documents which would show what these revisers had done had been lying for centuries in two libraries in England. And these two libraries were those to which one would naturally turn for evidence upon the early English Bible, the Bodleian Library at Oxford and the Lambeth Library attached to the palace of the Archbishop of Canterbury, London. So in other words, if you were going to say, where would we go to look for evidence of what happened, these are two obvious places that you might want to go to look, right? The Bodleian Library at Oxford, as well as the Lambeth Palace Library. And lo and behold, two things have been there for a long time. The unusual opinion has been that the revisers did little more than to prepare and edit for the printer the copy prepared by the translators. Actually, however, they polished the copy and provided considerable of the beauty of the King James Version. The revisers converted a version much like the Bishop's Bible, which, by following the rules of King James and the translators, had produced into the present noble literary monument. So what is Willoughby saying? He's saying that these documents speak and illuminate the process of them translating or transferring or transforming the Bishop's Bible into what? The King James Bible.
Can I make a comment?
Yeah.
Or ask a question? Willoughby makes a distinction between the translators and the revisers. Is he talking about two different procedures? I mean, the revisers, is he referring to the printers when it actually went from the translators to the print shop? who are the revisers?
Yeah, so I agree with you. His use of those two terms is confusing. He does that throughout the whole thing. So my only, the thing I fall back on is he's just using that interchangeably somehow, okay? I do agree with you, though. On the surface of it, it does appear to be a little confusing. The translators are revisers in that they're revising a bishop's Bible and turning it into what? A King James Bible.
In that, his last paragraph there, he says, the usual opinion has been that the revisers did little more than to prepare and edit the copy prepared by the translator. So it sounds like it's two different groups of people.
So he's either confused when he says that, or he's using them interchangeably, or he's somehow thinking that the guys that are responsible for this are somehow wholly different from the rest of the translators. I do agree with you. It's a little confusing the way he uses the words.
Printers do edit, make them edit sometimes, but not...
Well, we'll see when we get to talking about the actual 1611 that the printers do impact the final product. Or a la the She Bible. I mean, that's a print... The She... Saying She in that verse is a clear printer error. Okay? Now... The question that's outstanding is, do the printers impact the text in other ways? Alright? I think the answer is yes. Now, many King James only advocates are going to say no. They're going to say that any difference, they're all printer errors. And I'm saying, when you look at the documentation, where you can see the choices the translators are making, I don't think you're at all on solid ground to say that any difference is automatically a printer error, because I think some of them could have been intentional choices. Okay? And we'll get into all that, though, in the right place. Right now, we're just sort of still looking at this from a 1,000-foot view. All right?
In that same paragraph, it says they polished the copy. Was that all this prior to the king giving his okay to the translation, or was...
This is done after the... This is the first draft work of the Second Westminster Company, recording what they thought the changes to the bishop's Bible should be.
But it hasn't been approved by the king yet.
Well, no. The king never approves it in that sense.
Oh, okay.
He has set up the project, he's okayed the project, but he's not looking at every page, every word, every reading and saying, okay, I stamp my approval on that page and that page and that. That never happened.
But this little polishing happens after all the translation work.
So what we're going to see, Bart, is that even on this document here, okay, I got a whole lesson on this, where we're actually going to break this down and look at these readings. Even on this document here, they make further changes to what they even have recorded on this document. That's why I'm saying this is a first stage. This is emblematic of first stage revision. Okay? Alright, next point. Having been recognized by Willoughby in 1955 for its true value, it would take another 2 decades before a published work granted public access to the insights found in Manuscript 98. In 1977, Ward Allen published Translating the New Testament Epistles, 1604 to 1611, a manuscript of King James Westminster Company for Vanderbilt University Press. Allen's work is a full collation of Manuscript 98 against both a 1602 Bishop's Bible and a 1611 Authorized Version. Today, one can see select pages of Manuscript 98 at the Lambeth Palace Library website, like I just have been showing you here. So, in the case of MS 98, its significance is not discovered until when? 1955. Access to it, to the public. And what I mean by that is through a published book that you could go buy, talking about it and laying out its readings, was not available until 1977. Okay? And this is Warren Allen's book. So before that, if you wanted to know what it said, where did you have to go?
The library.
You had to go to Lambeth Palace Library and look at it yourself. Obviously, there is no internet then. We can't even look at images like this. So I'm here all mad that I can only see 10 pages when I should be happy about that, right? Compared to not having been able to see any. But anyway.
So even today, they don't have it photocopied on them?
They don't have the whole document digitized. They have limited how many images they're making available to the public. So this is all very controlled by these British libraries. Okay. Now, before we move on to the next document, does anybody have any further questions at this time about Manuscript 98? Now, I do have the book by Ward Allen. I've showed it to you before. I'm not going to spend time to go dig it out right now with my document files, but I do have the book, the 1977 book from Ward Allen. And let me also say, I have spent hours comparing the pages that are released on the Lambeth Palace Library website with Ward Allen's work, and I have confirmed that every released page that I can check against Ward Allen, that Ward Allen is giving an accurate representation of the document in his 1977 book. Okay? So you don't have to just take my word for it, which I'm happy about, because otherwise I don't like it when people just have to take my word for it. So are there any other questions then about Manuscript 98? Okay, let's go to the next one, Bod 1602. The second work in progress document that commands our attention is Bod 1602. As I have said many times in this class, Bod 1602 is a 1602 Bishop's Bible in the possession of the Bodleian Library at Oxford, containing the handwritten annotations of the translators in the margin. Its importance to understanding the translation process utilized by the King James translators cannot possibly be understated. Both of these documents, Manuscript 98 and Bod 1602, are huge. Okay? The Annals of the Bodleian Library, Oxford, edited by William Dunn McCrae, notes receipt of the volume in 1646 via the following entry, quote, item, for a large Bible, wherein is written down all the alterations of the last translation. So we know that entered into the archive of the Bodleian Library is an entry for a large Bible, wherein are written down all the alterations of the last translation, and it is entered into that library in 1646. So the only historical document that could apply to would be which Bible? The King James. Okay? So this is the first known entry about this document into the Bodleian Library. Alright? More than 200 years later, a short discussion of Bod 1602 can be found in B.F. Westcott's 1863 publication, A General View of the History of the English Bible. Pages 156 and 157 contain the following footnote clearly referencing the document. Quote, it is remarkable that none of the many copies of the Bishop's Bible used for the revision have yet been discovered. There is an interesting volume in the Bodleian Library, Bishop's Bible, Baker, 1602, which is commonly supposed to be one of the copies prepared for the press. The text is correct throughout. I think we want to say corrected. I need to check that, but I think it should say corrected throughout some of the books to the Royal Version, and in some cases, G, J, T, which appear to indicate the sources from which the corrections, the corrections were derived. Mr. J. Wordsworth, fellow of Brasenose, has kindly given me the following summary and extent of the corrections. So he's talking now about Genesis 1 through 25 with G. So G would have been Geneva. J, I'm not sure what J would have stood for. T would have been Tyndall. J, I don't remember who J would stand for. Then there's corrections from Genesis, 26 to Joshua. There's corrections from Judges through Isaiah 4, corrected with letters, and also Jeremiah 1 through 4, Ezekiel 1 through 4, Daniel 1 through 4, the minor prophets. And there's corrections in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, parts of John. And there are also two notes in a couple verses there in Ephesians and 2 Thessalonians. Go to the top of page 6. For the collation which I owe to the kindness, which I owe to the great kindness of Reverend H. O. Cox, the Bodleian librarian, it is certain that G. Mark's corrections obtained by the Geneva version, the material which I have are not as yet sufficient to identify the T and the J. I would say the T is probably Tyndall, but I'm speculating slightly. Okay? The history of the book is unknown, but the occurrence of the reference letters is at least a certain proof that it was not designed for the press. In all, probably it contains simply a scholar's collation of the royal and bishop's texts with an attempt to trace the origin of the corrections. The corrections throughout the Old Testament are apparently in the same hand. Those in the New Testament are in a different hand and considerably more modern. So that's what Westcott said about it in 1863. All right? Now, let's just stop there. Does he have an awareness of its existence? Does he know there's a document in the Bodleian Library that has something to do with the King James and the bishops? Now, he doesn't know exactly what he's looking at yet, but look at the next quote. Wouldn't you guys mind shutting the door for me, please? There is no doubt that Westcott is talking about Bod 1602. In the footnotes from pages 156 to 157. That said, a couple observations are in order. First, the existence of the document was known to people in the scholarly world of 19th century England. In addition to Westcott, at least two other people were aware of its existence, namely a Mr. J. Wordsworth and a Reverend H. O. Cox, the Bodleian librarian. Second, Westcott is clearly relying on second-hand information and not a first-hand examination of the document. So while the existence of Bod 1602 was known to the scholarly world of England in the 19th century, it remained largely unstudied and its true significance largely underappreciated. Willoughby talks about this very fact in his 1956 monograph. So Willoughby talks about this in this book right here that I've showed you twice already. He says, quote, the 19th century editor of the New Testament, Brooke Faustus Westcott, later Bishop of Durham, was misled by these remarks. In his general view of the history of the English Bible, he referred to John Wordsworth, later Bishop of Salisbury, who had examined this volume for him. In all probability, Westcott, following Wordsworth, concluded it contained simply a scholar's collation of the royal and bishop's texts with an attempt to trace its origin of these corrections. Had Bishop Westcott actually examined this volume, he would have realized that the final revision committee exercised a much greater influence than this over the work, not only of individual translators, but of the translating companies as well. He would not, we can be sure, have concluded, quote, it is not likely that this committee did more than to arrange the materials already completed, but whatever their work, it was completed in 9 months. So what Willoughby is doing there, is that he's acknowledging that Westcott talked about it, but he's saying that Westcott had not gone and looked at it himself, and so while its existence was known, its true significance was largely still what? Not appreciated. Alright? 2 decades later, in February 1888, Nicholas Pocock wrote an article for the Athenaeum, Journal of Literature, Science, the Fine Arts, Music, and Drama, titled The Bishop's Bible of 1568, 1572, and 1602, in which Bod 1602 is explicitly discussed. Willoughby is unaware of this mention of Bod 1602, as he refers to McCary's entry in the Annals of the Bodleian Library as, quote, the only other notice of this Bible known to me. We need a quotation mark after the word me there. The following screenshots are taken from pages 222 through 245. So if you go to page 7, this is the screenshot. These are, I didn't want to type all this, okay? So I just took screenshots out of the Athenaeum here from 1888 of this entry by Pocock, okay? You'll notice, if you look at page 7, about halfway down the page, he mentions Westcott. The only attempt at describing these corrections that I have seen is in Dr. Westcott's valuable History of the English Bible, where he observes truly that the handwriting of the notes in the New Testament is different from the Old. And then if you go to page 8, he does provide 15 examples of annotational changes that are found in Bod 1602. Okay? And then he even gives a little bit of commentary on where some of the reading changes may have came from. So now we have a second 19th century British author, this time writing for the journal, the Athenaeum Journal, who is talking about Bod 1602. All right? Let's go to page 9. And I want to read the end of this. So I'm going to commend the 15 examples to you to check out on your own. We might look at them later, but we're not going to do it in this lesson, okay? Okay, more. The everlasting fire. Okay, last paragraph, page 9 of that, second to last paragraph. Such is a specimen of only a few out of the many suggestions made by the revisers in St. Matthew's Gospel. So all 15 of those examples were from Matthew, which were not fully adopted by the company. Many of them will bear a comparison with those of any other version and indicate good scholarship and independent thought on the part of him who made them. It should be added that at that, in some cases, the original suggestion was erased and the reading finally adopted, submitted in the same handwriting. The present writer, now here's the key, the present writer had no time during a hurried visit to Oxford to pursue the investigation as far as he could have wished. Perhaps some other person may be induced to take up the subject. So what's he saying there? He's saying that there was a whole lot more about this that still needed to be what?
Investigated.
Okay? So it's important to note the following from this piece by Pocock. First, he has read Westcott's description of the document from his 1863 publication, A General View of the History of the English Bible, see above. Second, Pocock speculates that Bod 1602 might have served as a rough draft for the authorized version, noting annotations signifying various stages of revision. Thirdly, he offers 15 examples of readings from Bod 1602 and how their revisions impact the King James. Lastly, he confesses that his visit to Oxford was, quote, hurried, and that he was unable to pursue the investigation as far as he could have wished. So Pocock's piece in the Athenaeum demonstrates an awareness of Bod 1602's existence in the Bodleian Library in the late 19th century. And by the way, while I'm talking about it, I should have had the picture of Bod 1602 up here, but here it is. So here we have the Bishop's Bible, and you can see here, can you see this word scratched out and other words written in? All through here there are annotations of things that are scratched out and other things that are written down. Okay? What paragraph am I on? Second from the bottom, right?
Yes.
Pocock's piece in the Athenaeum demonstrates an awareness about 1602's existence in the Bodleian Library in the late 19th century. That said, by Pocock's own admission, the document remained largely unstudied and underappreciated in terms of its significance. It would not be until nearly a century later that its true importance was realized. As in the case of Manuscript 98, it was Dr. Edward Willoughby in the 1950s who identified Bod 1602 as instrumental to the translation work of the King James Bible. Once again, Adam Nicholson tells the story. Go to page 10. The third document is more intimate in the process of translation than either the Lambeth manuscript or the Iyer letter. It is a record of a scholar in the very purpose of, in the very process of translating. It too had been lying ignorant, It too had been lying ignored for centuries in a famous British library, and it too was discovered by the indefatigable Dr. Willoughby on his great 1950s trawl. He found it in the Bodleian Library in Oxford. The book, which Dr. Willoughby discovered, was an edition of the Bishop's Bible printed in 1602, which of course was the Elizabethan version of the English Bible on which Bancroft's rules required the translators to base their own. 40 copies in unbound sheets were said to have been acquired for their use and distributed to them. The Bodleian volume was probably one of those sets later bound together. It was acquired by the library in 1646 for 13 shillings and four, what did we say D was?
Pence.
Maybe pence, I don't know, denarius.
The D stands for,
I thought we looked this up and I can't remember.
Demetrium?
Something like that, yeah.
So
it was acquired by the library in 1646 for 13 shillings and cataloged as, quote, a large Bible, wherein is written down all the alterations of the last translation. What no one realized at the time, or for another three centuries, was that this Bible was not only an account of the alterations made, it was an instrument in the translation itself. So, what Westcott thought is that somebody went through this after the fact and just noted all the changes. What Willoughby is the first guy to realize is that no, it's not that somebody went through this after the fact and noted all the changes between the Bishop's Bible and the King James Bible, but that this was an actual instrument used by the translators in the process of doing their work. Are you following that? Okay. So, published access to the treasure that is Bod 1602 was not granted until 1995, when Ward S. Allen and Edward C. Jacobs published The Coming of the King James Gospels, a collation of the translator's work in progress for the University of Arkansas Press. This important volume provides a complete collation of Bod 1602 and the 1611 text for the Gospels. So even with as great as this book is and as useful as it is, it does not include the whole Old Testament. It includes Matthew through John. So let's look at it. Bod 1602. Bod 1602 is discovered, its true significance is realized by Willoughby. When? 1955. When is access granted to it to people outside? It's not until 1955 when again we see Ward Allen and Jacobs publishing their book in 1995. Okay? So, once again, to the next point, at the risk of sounding like a broken record, we must point out that the American King James Only movement enunciated a position in the mid-20th century without an awareness, much less a working knowledge of this important primary source. Are you following that? Mm-hmm. Now, for the sake of time, we're going to skip Boyce, and I want to go to the conclusion, because I want to drive this point home, and I have enough time to do it, I think. We'll come back to Boyce. We'll talk about him at the beginning of the next lesson. Conclusion. The three work-in-progress documents discussed in this lesson, knowing that we're going to talk about Boyce next time, were largely lost to history until they were rediscovered by scholars in British libraries in the 1950s and 60s. Published works notifying the public as to their important content were not available until 1969, in the case of the notes of John Boyce, and I do need to amend this a little bit. I need to include Willoughby here. But 1977, in the case of Manuscript 98 by Ward Allen, and 1995, in the case of Bond 1602, again by Allen and Jacobs. Given the publication dates for this first wave of King James-only books published in the United States, the so-called leading lights of the King James-only movement were largely ignorant of the three work-in-progress documents discussed in this lesson. 1930, Our Authorized Bible Vindicated was published by Benjamin Wilkinson. 1955, God Wrote Only One Bible by Jasper James Ray. 1964, The Bible Babble by Ruckman. 1970, The Christian Handbook of Manuscript Evidence by Peter S. Ruckman. And 1970, Which Bible by David Otis Fuller. Notice the publication dates of all of those books. All of those books were written without a working knowledge of the documents that we're talking about right now. And in many, not only no working knowledge of the documents, but in many of the cases, if you triangulate the dates on when the books were written with when other things were written, not only did they not have a working knowledge, in many cases they didn't even have an awareness that these documents existed. You guys following that? Okay. So let's look at the conclusion there on page 12. And again, we'll talk about Boyce next week. We're just, for the sake of time, I decided to move him. These books by Wilkinson, Ray, Ruckman, and Fuller set the content for the King James only movement going into the 1970s, 80s, 90s, and early 2000s. As a result, things were said about the King James Bible that were not true and devoid of any factual basis that were then, things were said about the King James Bible that were not true and devoid of any factual basis that were then repeated in an uncritical manner in later pro-King James literature. Even today, many so-called leading lights of the King James only movement refuse to acknowledge or engage with these three work-in-progress documents. I have run into this, where I'm talking about this stuff, and some folks are not pleased with me.
Okay? They have too much stuff on tape.
Maybe it's because they have too much stuff on tape or too much stuff already written. Whatever the reason is, okay, there's some folks that aren't pleased that I'm bringing this up. But I cannot continue to say certain things when I know that there are these documents in existence that would correct my understanding of certain things that I've said in the past. You guys following that? Okay? So, over the next couple of lessons, we will look at what these documents can tell us about the traditional process. I don't know why I said traditional there, but let's take that out. About the process utilized by the King James translators. I think I meant translational process, not traditional. But anyway, over the next couple of lessons, we will look at what these documents can tell us about the translational process utilized by the King James translators, as well as consider any insights, just say insights, they might provide into the readings found in the King James Bible. Okay, we are right at the time limit here, and does anybody have any quick questions or comments? Look, I hope you're not bored by this, because this stuff right here that we're talking about is the stuff that needs to be discussed, that needs to be made known in this whole conversation, and up until this point, it largely has been ignored. Okay? Any questions? All right, I'm going to stop the stream so we can pack up the equipment. If you have a question or want to make a comment when we're free of the internet, by all means, stick around while I'm cleaning up. Appreciate your attention. Next week, I'm going to slide the stuff about John Boyce to the top, and then we'll go from there. But I think next week's pages are like another